and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, the one and only Mr. Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
I want to make a mention. Tonight, we have a live video stream, and we're going to be joined by the legendary Echo Bodine. We're also going to be joined by Jamie Houck. Tonight, we're going to be talking about breaking spiritual connections with the living and the dead. There's a lot of this going on, and we briefly touched on this a week or two ago on our program, and people really took to it. I've had a lot of people say, God, this sounds great. I'd love to learn how to do this. So I reached out to the lovely and talented Ms. Bodine and Ms. Houck, and they're going to join us tonight to talk about when we come into contact with people, how we absorb some of that energy and make these spiritual connections with people. And the dead are also drawn to us, and how we can start to clear this. When you just start feeling drained for no reason, is there a reason? Is there a spiritual essence, a connection, an oppression, maybe even, I always hate to use the term because people are always asking about attachments, but, you know, we do make attachments to the living and the dead. And sometimes we need to clear those pathways to live a richer, better, healthier life. So that's what we're going to discuss tonight on the program live on YouTube. You can go find us at Darkness Radio, our YouTube channel. Subscribe. It's free. Hit the little bell. That's free as well. Then also, you could catch us on social media. It'll be on our Facebook page, Twitter, and so on. So make sure you go check that out tonight live. Tomorrow, for those of you that listen to the podcast, it'll be made available, audio-only podcast, on the program as a bonus episode. I want to remind everybody, I'm going to be at the Michigan Paracon in August. It's coming up quick now. There are a few tickets that still remain, miparacon.com. There'll be a link for it in today's episode guide so you can find it. But this is the biggest and probably one of the boldest paranormal conferences every year, and they have a chock-a-block full roster of amazing speakers from just about every paranormal show that you can possibly think about. So make sure that you go check that out, miparacon.com. You'll find information and tickets there. You can also just go to darknessevents.com, click on the tab, and you'll see all the locations that I'll be visiting, all of the different states and talks that I'll be doing. And Cindy Kazel and Shane Pittman will be joining me along the way on some of these. So make sure you go check that out. Tim, today's guest is interesting. He has a new book that's coming out. It'll be coming out in about mid-August. But I got an email from him just kind of reading this cursory glance at his story. It tackles a lot of things we've talked about on the show. And there were a few lines in this write-up that really drew my attention in this. And I can see how people would hear a story like this and be dismissive of it. Mm-hmm. Leaving people that are afflicted with dealing with these type of issues, feeling isolated, alone, depressive, maybe even having their own suicidal thoughts because they feel like they're an island unto themselves. It's heartbreaking in the story that this gentleman had to live through to begin with, but then to know that trying to deal with it, trying to find help has been even more heartbreaking for him. So this is something that I felt very strongly about talking about on the show, and I think it'll tie in nicely with tonight's show as well. Our guest has written a book called Devil Take the Hindmost. It is not available yet. It'll be out mid-August. If you go to Amazon, there is another book, but it's about financial issues. That's not it, so don't buy that book. When the book officially releases, we'll put out a link for that as well. You can also check darknessradio.com. Click on the shop tab. You'll see our Amazon link. You go into our Amazon store. We put up all the books that we cover on the show in our Amazon store so that you can find them all conveniently there. We have our true crime books, our paranormal books, and gifts and other items all categorized. So when this book becomes available and our guest tells me it's officially out, I will add it to our Amazon list so that way people can find it more easily. Devil Take the Hindmost. And now, Tim, I know I'm going to butcher the name, even though I've talked with him about this before we came on. Yep. I could go with the cheap Americanized version of it and probably get away with it, but I'm going to do my best to be respectful. Today, we're going to talk about a possession and an oppression case. Our guest and survivor, Michael Gagliardi. Was that pretty good, Michael? Did I get close to the Italian pronunciation?
Not bad for an American.
I'll take it. I'll take it.
Not bad. Well,
Michael, the letter you sent me is heartbreaking in so many ways, talking about what you've lived through. I can't even imagine, A, going through what you had to, and then B, to have to deal with the aftermath of this for so long alone. Yeah. So this is 40 years or more in the making. Take us back to the beginning of your story, if you would, and give us some insights into what happened and how this happened.
Well, when I was very young, we lived in Toronto. And feel free to ask questions as we go along, because it's difficult for me. It's
I understand.
A lot of post-traumatic stress, and it gets me shaking when I talk about it. But my mother, at a very early age, and my sister remembers this, and she's 7 years older than I am, but it started with little things around the house, as you know, most possessions start with banging, knocking, things of that nature. My mother in the early days, and I'm going to say 1972, 1973, when I was, you know, three and four years old, started to act weird, started to neglect me. And the first interesting thing that happened that I remember as far back as I can remember, and this is in the book, is that, you know, being Italian, we always had pasta fasule, which is like star soup for kids kind of deal. And my mother would always, you know, pour a bowl of it and then call me to the table. This one time, and I remember I was about three and a half. She called me to the table, but it wasn't there. And she poured soup all down my left shoulder. And it was scalding hot and burning. And I screamed. God. And I remember her taking me in a taxi to the doctor, never saying a word, never comforting me, never saying it was all right, just trance-like. And, you know, I remember this because this was such a poignant day. And she never held me, never touched me, never did anything. We went to the doctor, so I guess I was bandaged up. But all I remember, I don't remember, you know, the after effects of that, but I do remember the lack of love and lack of attention. So that was the earliest thing that I can remember. And then we moved into a house in Toronto. And then from there, things like this began. She would complain about hearing voices. She would, and this is all stuff that I would overhear at 4 years old, you know, and she would, you know, say there's little people running around the house and make references to seeing things and hearing voices. And then by that time, I was 5 years old, and then we moved 100 miles away. We had a drastic change in our life, and I don't know what happened, but my parents, well, my father, decided to move us 100 miles away, and he still worked in that area, so he had to drive 100 miles and stay down there for 5 days.
Well, now, so let me ask you, Michael, your mom is experiencing this. Is anybody else in the family experiencing strange supernatural occurrences?
Well, that's a great question, because I have since tried to track down many family members, several that have hung themselves, and tried to find out where the entry point was, because I've done a tremendous amount of research over the last, you know, 30 years. And I remember them talking about in the early years before we moved. This is when I was around 5 years old, and we moved from the city to a rural area. I remember that her and her sister talking about seances and stuff like this. And I you know, casually remember talk of that nature. And what brings me back to that point, to thinking that that was the entry point, is that my mother loved my father her father very much. She adored him. And he died in a tragic accident being drunk, inebriated, and then stumbled onto a railroad track and got his legs cut off by a train. You know, in Toronto, back in those days, you would have a backyard and have no fences, and the railroad track would go right through the backyard. So, you know, they had easy access. So that was my understanding of what may have been the beginning of this, that she may have contacted, you know, through a seance or something like that, my grandfather or her father, because she loved him and missed him. And the pieces I put together, you know, because I was too young, but later on in life, I put the pieces together, you know, when my family members would say that, you know, my grandmother, you know, my mother's mother went off the rails at that time and went out, you know, partying and doing all this kind of stuff. And my mother was left to tend to her other two siblings. So there's
now,
that.
Michael, but, let me ask you, and I know,
yeah,
I know because I've read the letter that you sent me. And I certainly don't want to be to trigger anything for you, but I know our listeners following along immediately have seen some red flags pop up, especially if there's been suicides and alcoholism and things in your family. Was there
sure.
any state of, I guess, mental issues in the family that you were aware of?
Well, you know, a lot of people think, you know, demonic possession and, you know, mental illness are either the same or slightly different. But when you hear the rest of my story, that will change your opinion, because she began to have these experiences and she began to deteriorate. By the time we moved to a rural community when I was 5, you know, it progressively started to get worse, that by the time I was, I'm going to say between 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, she was spending all of her days sitting in a chair, having conversations with herself, completely entranced. You could clap your hands in front of her and she wouldn't pay any attention to you. And she would growl and her voices would change as she would talk between, you know, it was like she was having a conversation with several different people. And she wasn't even aware you were even there. And it progressively got worse by the time I was 15, 16, where she was now mutilating herself. I mean, spending 9 to 12 hours sitting in a chair, hitting herself with a log and a boot all day long, and dropping her leg, lifting her leg up and dropping her leg down, and having conversations and screaming and whistling, you know, whistling songs. And this kind of stuff went on day after day after day after day for years.
How did your father deal with this, aside from moving you 100-plus miles away?
My father was disengaged.
Okay.
He was a refugee in Italy, so he came to this country with nothing. He was traumatized in his own right, you know, being in the war, only going, having a fourth grade education. He was never home. See, this was the thing. Because we moved 100 miles away, he would go back down to work and spend, you know, 5-6 days down there and come up on the weekend for a day and a half and then go home. And oddly enough, and this is odd, but he, being my father, he didn't speak English very well. He doesn't understand things. And he basically ignored it and would just say, oh, you're crazy, and wouldn't even pay any attention to her. But had no clue that this was going on day after day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, because he was only there such a short time, only for, you know, 24 hours or so, you know, to come home and do his banking and stuff like that, and then return back down to Toronto. By the time I was 16, we had an incident where my mother tried to kill my sister. And this was one of the big incidents that happened. because we live in Canada, we have, you know, it's cold country. We have a mud room, you know, and when I went to school that day, which was, you know, at the beginning, the end of May, so it was kind of nice out, I left two of the doors open to the mud room and to the exterior outside door. I left those open. So there was just the door from the mudroom to the living room that was closed. My mother charged at my sister, saying that she was a witch, with a big butcher knife, and she was right behind her, and she was able to open the door. And because I had carelessly left both doors open, she told me she was able to get out. And if she had to spend the time on one of the doors, which was one of those push button screen ones, because it stuck, she said she would have been killed. So what happened is she chased her around outside, around the car, and then the neighbors called the police, and then they had come, and then that was the first time they took her away. They took her away to a mental institution. And that was the beginning of things even getting way worse. So she went to this mental institution for three months.
Let me ask you this. Aside from what seems to be afflicting your mother personally, and understand I'm only asking the questions that I know the majority of the audience has at this point, because again,
sure,
people want to push away the concept of diabolical intervention, demonic possession, because it's let's just be honest, Michael, it's a terrifying thought. And we, you know, it's right. Much easier to just say this woman's obviously in mental distress. She is obviously having a breakdown, yeah. And it can come on like that slowly and then just de-evolve. But
right.
With this, is there any other supernatural activity amping up? Are things moving? Are you hearing other things when mom is sitting still? You're hearing footsteps or seeing things. Does anything else amount to supernatural activity at this point around her?
Yes, this is when things began to get really bad. And her conversations during the day, I mean, they were evil conversations. And she's whacking herself with this log and with a boot constantly, all day long. There was a stench about her that was just incredible. And then at nighttime, and this is where I have my problems today, I still have blackouts today where I pass out when I become stressed because of nighttime. At nighttime, this is when the screaming began. This is where she would try to enter into my room, which, by the way, I would sleep with the dresser, this big dresser armoire against the door, and with a hockey stick. And I slept in the same fetal position for 10 years, leaving holes in the mattress from being in the same place. Now, what would happen at nighttime was the screaming during the night and banging going on in her room as if a brawl is happening. This, and it was so disturbing. And I just couldn't grasp what was going on. I mean, I was just, you know, in my early teens when this ramped up to incredible degrees, that in her room, things were banging against the wall, crashing on the floor, and I never went and opened her door because I was terrified. We were all terrified. My sister, who was living at home at the time, had a lock on her door because she would try to enter our rooms at nighttime. And, you know, screaming and maniacally laughing and hitting herself while walking up and down the hall trying to, you know, wiggle the doorknob, trying to get in. You know, and then that would last for maybe a couple hours, and then the banging would start in her room. And it sounded like three people in there fighting and throwing each other against the floor. And she'd be screaming. And I remember one time when my dad was home, he was like, "What the hell?" And I followed him and he ran in there. And my mom was lying on the bed saying that Satan was jumping on her chest. And he, you know, he completely discounted it. I was shaking like mad. And we went back out in the hallway and it continued. And we just ignored it. it became such a thing that happened every day and every night. And my father was only home on Saturdays. And by that time he had a girlfriend at that time. So he wasn't even staying home on Saturday nights, which was his only night home. So there were just, you know, me and my sister, and she locked herself away in her room with a padlock on her door from the inside of the door. And this is how we lived. She tried to burn the house down maybe 10 times. The fire department would mm-hmm. come. I mean, this isn't even the half of it. I mean, if you can, you read in my book, this kind of stuff went on every day. She would tell us, tell me things that I did that week or that day. And that she had no idea, because she barely ever left the house. If she ever left the house, all she did was go on our street and knock on doors and tell them she was going to cut their heads off. And one called the police.
Why?
Yeah. She would bang on their doors. They'd answer the door and she'd say, you know, in this voice, and tell them, I'm going to cut your head off. And she did this to all the neighbors. She terrorized the neighbors. And when the police would come, she'd be completely normal. And she'd, and just talk. I never heard the conversations between the police, because they sequestered us off in different rooms. You know, usually they took me into my room or took me outside. But this happened many, many times. The police came to our house many, many times. And no one was ever, even when she tried to kill my sister, after 3 months, she signed herself in when they got there, and she signed herself out in 3 months and came back home. And I mean, she attempted murder, and they still allowed her to come home with minors in the house, which was mind blowing. And from that point on, it even got worse. It got so terribly bad.
But now, again, just to kind of to reel it back in for a second, again, this is all centered around her, but would other things happen? It's curious that you mention she would have a knowing. She wouldn't be with you, and while you were out doing something, she knew what you were doing. That's telling.
Yes.
I'm trying to massage in the aspects of the supernatural, because still, yes, you know, being alone in a room hearing banging, screaming just sounds like a raging lunatic. But was there supernatural activity that she could sense things she shouldn't know? That becomes more powerful, and you start to see that.
Yes.
And in demonic cases, listeners, these demons do seem to have a handle on things that, you know, being able to see you, know your deepest, darkest secrets. Now, it can be easily said again in this case. And I want to preface this, so give me a second, Michael, because I know it'll sound almost combative to you, but I'll flesh the whole thing out. It sounds like we're dealing with a woman in complete mental distress, not afflicted in any way with the supernatural, and somebody that was almost sociopathic in the way that she could be out threatening, screaming, yelling, and then be in a calm demeanor. But you have to ask yourselves, what does possession look like? Even with priests, they'll show up to the house. This is true. Priests will come there with the idea to evacuate these demons, to release them, to help the afflicted. The person will seem normal. John Zaffis, Adam Bly, Father Andrew Calder, some of the people that we've spoken to over the years on the show will tell you, the afflicted sometimes become the nicest when they're there, because again, they're trying to throw the scent off of what is actually taking place in the normal world. So they do these things. To us, it sounds crazy, but if somebody is possessed, it would look crazy. The activity, all of this that you're explaining, that's why it would be so hard dealing with this affliction as a child, a survivor of watching your parent go down this mental route. Now, there's no saying, clearly, she was having a mental breakdown. Does one complement the other? Was her descent escalated by this demonic realm, or was her descent into madness the opening that this demon needed to get in and mess with her so that it could have control over her and try to hurt those around her? That's where we still are completely unsure of how this looks on the overall. So
there's more,
and looking at these different aspects, you start to see the key words of this woman knowing things she shouldn't know, Now, well, she's a mom. Moms know things. Well, that's true. But if you're a mile or two away doing something, you know, by yourself, and she has this insight, there's going to be these key elements that are going to trigger you to know that this is more than just a mad woman. This is a mad woman being afflicted by something as well. So I just wanted to take a moment to mention that. Now, you say this continues on. Were you or your sister seeing dark images, shadowy figures? Would you hear knocks and things coming from rooms where mom was not located, as though there was supernatural activity amping up?
Yes, yes, but it was hard to tell because, you know, the way we lived this every day was to just stuff it and not you know, ignore it. It became so frightening and terrifying that there was no way to deal with this. I mean, I look back on it now, you know, as an adult, and I see the demonic presence all over it because, you know, she predicted Kennedy's death. She predicted a whole bunch of things. She would tell me what I do, you know, what I did that day, or where was I, or, you know, very dark things that, you know, I was doing, and she was able to tell me them. And there were times when she was lucid for a moment, and she would tell me, she would, like, pleading with me, and I'm only like 12 or 13 years old, and I could see that she realized that, but she would plead with me in a way, saying, you know, they come in through the back of my neck, they run up my spine in the back of my neck. And she would say this on many occasions, you know, and when that would happen, you know, she would be absolutely gone. I mean, I could clap my hands and I did that. I'd yell in her face. I'd yell in her face and she wouldn't even acknowledge that I was there. She wouldn't even blink. She would continue going on like these conversations, talking, and she'd use different voices and different languages. She'd go back and forth with herself. Like, I'll give you an example. She'd be like, and then another person, and a split second later, she'd be laughing her head off, and then she'd go into a different voice. And it, what it seemed like I was only 13, so I didn't know, you know, what languages I, you know, but I could hear different languages. It wasn't English, you know, and this was terrifying, but it became so every day. And then while she was doing this, she would be hitting herself and mutilating herself. I mean, I would, by the time I was 16, I would leave the home and be gone for 7 days at a time, park my bike in, you know, in the, you know, where I parked my bike, come into the house. Before I'd enter the house, I could hear the thumping. And this is like, I haven't even been home, and I could hear the thumping, and I'd open up the door, and there she was, slamming herself in the chest with a log and screaming and talking and going on and on and on. It never ended. It is as if she never slept at all. Nighttime, I never heard her sleeping. I never heard her snoring. Daytime, she did these ritualistic things of hitting herself and talking, and which never ended, and whistling at the top of her lungs, clear as anything, and singing songs, you know. And I had read about this later on in my 40s about the Ronald Doe case, where, you know, he would whistle and sing songs and hymns and stuff like that. That's exactly what she did. And I had no clue what was going on. And it's now, good that I had no clue.
Stop you really quickly. For listeners, the Roland Doe case is the case that the movie The Exorcism was based on. That was the young boy on the, I believe it started on the East Coast, moved to Missouri. And this is where The Exorcism actually took place. So I just wanted to catch up our listeners on who Roland Doe was.
Well, to get back to the spirit, you know, the the phenomena part of it.
Right.
You see, none of us ever confronted her. We never confronted her. We'd say shut up or whatever, but it had no effect. She had become so obese, eating everything in the house, everything. I mean, rampaging through the house, eating everything, so incredibly unhuman-like that my father had to put a big chain and lock on the freezer downstairs. One time when I came home because we had a downstairs entrance from the outside, and we have an in entrance from the house. I came downstairs, and she was hacksawing the lock off the freezer. And I said, "Hey." She turned around, looked at me, snarled at me like an animal, and ran upstairs. I followed her upstairs, and she slammed the door and, you know, of her room. And she was holding the door closed, and I was trying to get in. And I could hear her snarling. And I don't know what drew me to push the issue, because I was shaking and terrified, but I felt at that point I'm going to die anyway. So I've either got to fight this or something. Anyway, for 10 minutes, I was pounding on the door, trying to get the door open. All she was doing was snarling from the other side, like an animal. Within 10 minutes, I felt the pressure of her back away from the door, and it was silent. Soon as I opened the door, and she came lunging at me. You know, she was 2 feet away from me. She opened the door and I saw her face. Her eyes were black, no pupils, no nothing. And the left side of her forehead was all bubbled out. It was all distorted. Her face was distorted. And she lunged at me. And when I saw her face, I freaked out. I ran outside. I was shaking so incredibly bad, I was stuttering. And I didn't know what to do. And she didn't follow me outside. So what I waited for 15 minutes, 20 minutes to calm myself down. I went back in the house. Our phone was right inside the door of the entrance in the living room from the mudroom. And it had a long, long cord on it. So I grabbed the phone and I pulled it as far as it could outside. And I called my dad, who was at his friend's house. And I couldn't even tell him what happened. I was like, I never got one word out. I was stuttering so bad. And he says, "Okay, I'm coming over." And then I hook up, I put the phone on the hook, because those are the old dial phones. And within 10 minutes, my dad showed up and he started to walk in the house and I followed him. The second he came into the house, my mom, being 300 pounds, she was at 300 pounds, 5 feet. She's 5 feet tall, maybe 280 to 300 pounds. She lunged at him, grabbed him, threw him to the floor with incredible strength. I mean, my dad was 5'8". 5'7" or 5'8". She threw him to the floor, got on top of him and started beating him. And my dad was completely in shock. He was completely in shock. I tried to pull my mother off. And as quick as it started, she got up, she stood up and went back in her room and closed the door. My dad was left there. I was thinking he was going to cry. I never seen a man so shaken up in my entire life, because she threw him to the floor like a doll and beat him. And he got up and he was shaking, and we both went outside and he couldn't talk to me because he was shaking so bad. So we stayed outside for about an hour, half an hour to an hour. And then my father called the police, and I don't know exactly who he called, but I remember the police came, and the mental institution people came, and they came in the house and they took her away in a straitjacket, and she was as calm as anything.
Good God. I cannot even imagine what it would be like as a child. First of all, your mother, that's your savior. That's the person that protects you, watches over you, and yes, is your, you know, rock. To see somebody devolve like this and to see them breaking, just even if it was simply a mental breakdown, would be enough to create havoc in somebody's world. But then to know that there is a supernatural element to it is, is even more.
That's what terrifying. I saw that day when I saw her face all contorted. That's it. It terrified me and traumatized me so bad that when I walked outside, I couldn't even, I couldn't function. My knees collapsed. I fell down on the ground on the concrete and I was shaking so bad. I was trying to utter words and I was like, I have never experienced such trauma in my life before like that. And I couldn't even say a word. And when I called my dad, it took me about 20 tries to do the phone number because it was the old rotary dial phone.
Right.
And yeah. I kept getting it wrong. And I kept doing the numbers wrong and putting my finger in the wrong space because I couldn't keep my hand still, you know, to rotate the dial. So it took me, I think, maybe 15, 20 minutes to actually get the right number. And then when my dad answered, I couldn't even say one word. I was just, you know, completely stuttering and I couldn't say one word. And, you know, believe it or not, when they took her away that day, she signed herself in again. And signed herself out 3 months later, because I guess back then that was the period that you could, that they were allowed to hold you because an incident had happened, you know, but the funny thing is the police, you know, I was a minor. Police, nobody did nothing. She came home twice and it got worse and worse and worse. You know,
now, were you able to get any information regarding her stints in mental institutions? What was going on with her then? Was she still exhibiting these strange behaviors, strange anything that you could get, or because of patient confidentiality, did they not open up about that?
Well, I had called them 3 weeks ago and they had told me, you know, that usually cases from that era, you know, are terminated and you don't think. But the lady said to me, oh, I see it right here. And she says, that's odd. We still have the documents in the archive. And she said, but it'll take me a day because it's off campus. And she never returned my phone call. And I still can't get a hold of her. So the documents were off campus. She said from those years, oh, they would have been burned if they're 20 years old or whatever. They would have been thrown out and terminated. But she said, that's odd. It says that they're here in the archives. And she never got back to me. She never. So the reports. I never got to see them. You know, I was just a kid. My dad didn't care at the time, you know. And we're talking a small town. It's a town of 4,000 in rural northern Ontario. So, you know, your police department, everybody knows everybody. And it was a very hush-hush. I felt like they covered it up because the police and the fire department were always at my house. They were always at my house. Because something was on fire, my mom would burn everything. She would put everything in the fire until the chimney caught on fire and the attic was heating up so bad that the sparks were flying out of the chimney and neighbors would call the police and call the fire department. So they were always out there. But it persisted and it persisted until, you know, and this is the conclusion of it. By the time I was 19, my mother and father had divorced, and he put her in an apartment building in, you know, a half an hour away. And when I went to see her and she was doing the same thing, so I said, I had enough of this. I can't deal with this. And I walked away, and I had made plans that year to move to California. And I was going to be homeless on the Sunset Strip, homeless at the Santa Monica Beach. I don't care. I had nothing to come home to. And that's exactly what I did. That's how I got to America. But
Well, let's do this. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll find out the rest of the story and where it leads us to today. Again, the information for the book will be out in a few weeks. We will update it. You can find it at darknessradio.com under our shop tab. Go to our Amazon shop link. And when the book is available in 2 weeks, we will have it there. The book called Devil Take the Hindmost. We will be back. Stay tuned. You're listening to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Dave. That's Tim. I want to remind everybody again, Michigan Paracon is coming up soon. It's at the end of August. I will be out there along with a plethora of other fantastic speakers. I hope that you'll come on out and see us. It is one of the premier paranormal events of the year. It's amazing. MIParacon.com is the website to get your information. MIParacon.com. And also, I'm working with a production company that is seeking footage. If you have any filmed footage of strange encounters, they're specifically looking for, they want anything supernatural. But if you have anything that you believe to be a shadow man, a cryptid creature, something bizarre and unusual like the Nightwalkers, anything like that, even angelic in nature. If you have any of that footage, please contact me. Send me the footage along with a paragraph about where you captured it, when you captured it, your name, full name, your phone number, and the best email address. I will forward it on to the production company. I have no final say in what pieces are selected or used, but I am the conduit between you and the production company. If you're interested in that, send it to me, and it may be featured on an upcoming episode, and you may be featured in an upcoming episode of a major TV program. So if you're interested, dave@darknessradio.com. If you have any compelling footage, not SLS camera, just straight video footage, whether it's from your Ring cameras, from your phone cameras, from your documenting cameras, whatever you've got, if you have some strange footage or know anybody that does and you can connect us, that would be fantastic. Send it to dave@darknessradio.com. Tonight, we've got our live video stream. Make sure you check out our Darkness Radio YouTube page. Subscribe to it. Click the bell so you never miss any of the new content. And you can also watch it on our social media. It'll be live tonight with Echo Bodine and Jamie Houck as we deal with spiritual attachments and release. We'll also be talking about how to heal yourself from these type of things. That will be made available tomorrow as an audio-only podcast right here on Darkness Radio. I also want to mention, remember, folks, there is a premium version of this show where you can get all of Darkness Radio and our Darkhives, along with our True Crime Tuesday program in total, all of it commercial free. $5 a month. That's basically what it breaks down to. $5 a month. And if you go get Stitcher Premium now and use code word Darkness Radio, all one word, or Darkness, you're going to get deep discount savings. And I can't remember, there were two different discounts, one for Darkness, one for Darkness Radio, all one word. So I don't remember which one is which. You could try them both, get the best discount you can for a year-long subscription. That will give you all of our content commercial free. So go check that out. Join Stitcher Premium family. And the best part is you don't just get the best in paranormal podcasting with Darkness Radio and the best in true crime talk radio with True Crime Tuesday. When you get the subscription, that $5 a month opens up the window for you to see and hear all of the content that Stitcher has. Hundreds of thousands of hours of podcasting premium shows with no commercials. So you get a lot of bang for your buck. Check it out right now. Go get Stitcher Premium. All right, we're back. Again, the book that'll be coming out in a few weeks, Devil Take the Hindmost, will be released around mid-August is the hopes at this point. Our guest today, Michael Gagliardi, and we're talking about his experience with a mother dealing with possession. And the aftermath, what the effects have been like for him. We've heard the heartbreaking story as it evolved from his very early childhood of around 4 years old to 19 years old. Michael, again, our hearts go out to you with this tale. I can't imagine the kind of fortitude you have to have personally to see something like this through and survive. So first of all, congratulations for making it through that and being here with us to tell this story. This may help others as well in understanding that they may not be alone if they're dealing with this. So you've decided you're going to get the hell away. You're going to America. You're going to separate yourself, put as much mileage as you can between your mom and yourself and what's going on. Take us on from this part of the story, please.
Well, you know, by that time, you know, I was 19, I was able to leave, and I had went to see my mother 1 week before I was going to leave for California. And my plans were to go to California and be homeless and figure out something, because anything was better than what I had here. And a lot of my friends and family say, man, I don't know how you have had the guts to do that. Well, it wasn't guts. It was anything was better than what was going on. You know, if I was going to be homeless on a beautiful California beach, that sounded much better than what I had, you know, gone through the last 12, 13 years. Anyway, so what had happened was I had seen her one last time. I had left her apartment, and it was within a day or two that I had left and then went to California. I was on a bus. I came to California. I had a family member that I stayed with for a couple of days. And I think it was exactly a week later that my family contacted me, because I had left a number of somewhere where I was staying. And they had contacted me and said that your mother had died. And wow. I wasn't shocked by that. And when they told me when she had died, that was the day that I left. So it was very interesting. It was like the mission was complete, in so to speak. But she was only 46 years old.
Was it a sense of relief? No. And I know that's horrible to say, but you know, I don't know if you're dealing with that all your life. Is that kind of a
no? It wasn't, because the damage had been done. By the time I was 19, I was having severe insomnia, maybe sleeping an hour a night and that lasted 10 years, the extreme insomnia. The after effects, like you were speaking of, I began this in school, where if you ever watched that movie, A Perfect Mind with Russell Crowe,
right?
That's exactly how I became. I became, you know, walking into a room and calculating my plan of escape, who in the room was a threat, how I would take them down, you know, all this kind of thing, you know, remembering shirt colors, pants, anything, you know, notable, hair color, weird haircut, and establishing threat levels with everybody. And I did this for decades. I couldn't drive my car without looking at license plates, computing license plates, and taking down information about what if something happened here. Well, it was by the palm tree in the corner of blah, 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 blah. It was madness, absolute madness. And this was the after effect of it. And it progressed and changed over the decades. Now I have blackouts. The craziness of my mind is still there, but not as bad. But now I have, when I have events of extreme stress, I just pass out. My body can't take it anymore, and I just pass out. I've probably passed out over the last 2 years, probably 12 times. And I passed out a couple times while writing this book. And even after this, you know, I met my wife very early on when I was 19. And when we had children, the paranormal stuff began to happen with us.
Let me ask you about that. Did you have a fear that what happened to your mother might happen to you and could end up
no
negatively influencing
never
your children? Okay.
No, I never did. I never did. But what had happened, you know, things began to happen when I was in my 20s. Actually, when I was 19, we had a big earthquake. Or maybe I was 20. We had a big earthquake, the big earthquake in Los Angeles. And my wife saw a crouched demon sitting in the corner seconds before we had a major earthquake. She was woken up by something and seconds before we had the major earthquake in California, that it was the Whittier quake that we were in. When that had happened, that had triggered my PTSD so terribly bad that I stuttered for 9 months after that, because I had just coming out of all of this stuff at 19 years old, you know, leaving Canada and, you know, thinking you think you have some sort of relief, but I never had any relief. And we had that earthquake and I stuttered from the trauma from that for 9 months. And, you know, things just continued. I've never been able to hold down a job that was like a 9-to-5. To this day, I'm a musician because that was my therapy when I was a kid. And that's what I do. I go play a place for an hour or two, do a concert, and then come home. That's about all I can process. Being around people, being in any sort of situation where I have to perform or be on or communicate, you know, that's about it. I've got a 2-hour limit and then I'm done. I can't do it anymore, you know? And these are the things that have manifest themselves, you know, and we've had many paranormal things happen over the years that we've been together. We've been together now 36 years. We had stuff with our kids. We had stuff in the house. In fact, just a few months ago, while I was writing this book, we had banging on the side of the house. I ran out there with a flashlight, you know, and my house, where my front door is, to the side of the house, the banging was on the wall where my head was against, and it was banging my head right off the wall. I was like, bonk, bonk, bonk. And I ran out with the flashlight. Took me maybe all of 2 seconds to get out the flesh, and there's nobody there. And I ran around the entire house, looked up on the roof, went on the roof, looked everywhere. That kind of thing has happened tremendously over the last 20 years. I've been sitting in a room and hearing a tea kettle whistle, full blast, in a small room. And then I feel like the only place anyone could hide is behind this armoire. And the second I get up, it stops. And that happened while I was writing this book. It happened several times while I was writing this book, and, you know, and we've had banging, we've had, you know, cupboard doors fly open. And my daughter now is experiencing that kind of thing. She lives in Yucca Valley and she's been experiencing things like that as well.
Michael, so, why do you think your family is afflicted with this type of activity?
Well, I'll tell you, and this is my opinion, that from the research that I've done over my family, I've had several people in my family hang themselves, from my dad's brothers to my cousins. And I've studied demonology for years. I'm actually a speaker on it now, but I can only do 2 hours of it, like I said. But after researching all this stuff, I know that demons, they've been around for a long time. They have the information and the knowledge of everyone's family. And they're assigned to families. They're assigned for the breakdowns of the families and to destroy people. And when people commit suicide, that is a demonic act. That is a demonic act. It is not, if you're killed by somebody, that's one thing. But to take your own life is such a low, a disparageable act of self-loathing. And I got to that point in my 30s. I was actually admitted to Yorba Linda, where I couldn't deal with life anymore. I just couldn't shut it off, because nothing shuts off. There's no rest. There was no rest for me. And I ended up in Yorba Linda. And when I was in Yorba Linda, I stayed 3-4 nights in there. Paranormal stuff was happening around me while I was there. And the guy, people there were like, what the hell, you know? And you know, this is what was going on even while I was trying to get help. And I've sought help from psychologists. I've had a number of psychologists just tell me, I can't deal with this. I can't help you, and send me on my way.
Are they saying that because they're not prepared to deal with the supernatural, or are they saying it because they were being dismissive and think you're just crazy? And
no,
okay.
No, they were overwhelmed by what I was telling them. They were completely overwhelmed. It was beyond their scope of ability to find reasoning, to cultivate some reasoning in this to help me. In fact, one psychologist told me, you need to go see a POW a psychologist, one who's because this is the worst stuff I've ever heard. And I never went to him because I thought, you know, there's a thing about this kind of thing. It's that, you know, it's with anything. You don't want to talk to somebody who doesn't understand your experiences, who hasn't gone through something. You know what I mean? Like talking to a psychologist about things they have no knowledge of, that doesn't help you any. You know, it's like that statement, you know, that, you know, birds of a feather flock together, or, you know, to know one is to be one, you know, and stuff like that. You know, you can't talk to somebody. My situation, my story is so extreme that people just can't deal with it. The psychologist, I talked to psychologists at County who I was asking, could you just please refer me to somebody who could help me? Nobody could help me. Everybody that I went to, they were like, I can't help you. I can't help you. This is beyond me. It is too overwhelming. And it is a rarity. And that's why you were saying in the very beginning, that's why I feel completely so isolated and a freak and so by myself in this world, because I can't find other people that have had these experiences and for so long. I mean, you hear about a possession or something that's a couple of weeks or a couple, you know, in the Annalise Michelle case, it was, 9 months, but this went on for me for 12, 13 years, day in, day out. There was never a day of rest, never a day of rest. My mother was full scale by the time I was 12 or 13 into these yelling, screaming, talking in voices, other languages, yelling at herself, you know, talking to different people, going, switching languages and people. I'm talking voices completely different from each other in matter of split seconds and hitting herself. This never ended. Like I said, I'd go away for 7 days and come back and hear it by the time before I even walked into the house. And that was shocking to me to think that I never heard her sleep. It was as if there was no rest. And I didn't know how to deal with this. Now, you could understand that for having the mother is the pinnacle of the family, making dinner and stuff like this. This created a whole nother aspect of issues for me where I was starving and my father was gone. And I had to steal. So I stole from gardens in the summer and I stole kids' lunches in the wintertime. I was a thief and they never caught on to who was stealing all the lunches of school for years. You know, they will now, but these are all the issues. I never had clothes. I had to wear girls' clothes. I wore boots that were too small that cramped my feet. You know, my legs were bloody from getting chapped and no one took care of me. So this mental abuse continued day after day. And it was different because Canada, we have seasons. So every season I know here comes the torture of winter. You know, all we had was a fireplace, you know, to heat the home. Well, it doesn't heat up the whole house if you're in your room with a big drawer pushed up against your bed. It doesn't heat your room. So you're freezing. It's minus 60 degrees out and you're freezing, you know, and trying to sleep and you got insomnia and you're waiting for your mother to kill you. And this just never ended.
God. Now, yeah, can you tell me, Michael, what part of the are you in Canada now, or are you still here in the United States?
No, I'm actually in Palm Desert. In Palm Desert. I've been here since that day I left. I've been here for 36 years.
Because I would like, off air, I would like to connect you with a couple of people that I firmly believe will believe you and might be able to help get you some help to deal with this. Dr. Raymond Moody has been doing a lot of work in helping people with PTSD and helping them to release the spirits and release themselves from this. And I believe he can help. And if he is unavailable, we have some other resources that might be able to help you through this and deal with the attachments. So I'd like to help you connect with those people that, again, we trust, we love, and have been longtime fans and friends of our show that are very good at helping people in your situation.
Yeah, I have yet to run into somebody with a case. So, I mean, my case is basically like the Roland Doe, like the Annalisa Michelle, except for an extended period of time, for 12, 13 years. I saw things that a child shouldn't see. I heard things, you know, that a child shouldn't hear. And it completely broke me down as a human being. And I believe that was the issue. That's what demons are all about. They're all about destroying the institute, you know, that God has provided from the very beginning, which is the man and the woman, a family and children, you know, and that's what they do. They come into a family, they know everybody's ticks, and they go after you. They go after you, and they go after the vulnerable. And that's why I named it Devil Take the Hindmost, because my sister, once my mother tried to kill her, she left. She left a couple, you know, 4 or 5 months later, she left. And then there was just me left in the house. And my sister, when I talked to her, she said she had great guilt leaving me there all alone. So it was just me and my mother there. And that's when things escalated to incomprehensible levels, the things that I heard and seen on a daily basis, that I was so freaked out now. Because I was older, I was able to process things better at 17, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old, that I had to leave the house. Even if I slept outside in the park, I had to leave the house. I had to not be there, you know, because it just got so bad. And it's like, how much can a human being take, you know, when you're subject to this abuse 24 hours a day? It never stops. Even when you're not there, it's still going on, you know? And that's what was the hardest part for me. And to this day, I still, like I said before, I can't hold a job. I can't do much of anything longer than 2 hours. And I'm mentally done. I'm mentally cooked. I have to go home and depress, you know? So it's been an incredible journey. But the one thing that, you know, there's a couple of good things that did happen from it. I became in school. Maybe some of your listeners would think, well, how did you do in school? It probably was a wreck. No, I was an overachiever academic. I won everything there was to win. Academic, captain of this, captain of that, championship of this. I've got award of excellences, honor student. I've got tons to show nobody. You know, when I was a kid, I had no one to show them to. I don't know, maybe I was trying to in some way, you know, impress somebody to pay attention or give me some love at that point, because I didn't even know what love was. But I was a complete overachiever all the way up to high school. By the time I hit grade 10, it was over. I dropped the ball and I said, I'm done. I can't do this life anymore. And my grades began to fail. And I didn't start showing up to school anymore. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that was I focused on guitar. I had found my escape. And my escape was music. And that's what I do to this day. I'm a national recording artist, flamenco, jazz, smooth jazz. And that's what I do. And it gives me therapy. And, you know, when I go play, I go play for an hour or 2 hours. I do a concert somewhere and then I'm done. And I come home and I'm kind of like Neil Peart. I don't hang around and shake hands. And, you know, when the show's over, like from Rush, Neil Peart would finish the show. He'd jump off his kit and right. run in, get into the car and take off to the hotel. That's me. All the other guys stick around in the band and I'm gone. You know, I'm gone because I just can't deal with the process, you know, of having to communicate with people. I couldn't even talk on the phone till I was, 24, maybe. My wife had to talk on the phone for me. I couldn't make a phone call. It was terrible. It was terrible. I was that secluded, you know, that cut off from society, you know. So it was very difficult. It's still very, very difficult for me today. When I lay my head down every night, last night was no exception. When I lay my head down, here come the shakes. And the shakes get so bad that I have to wait for this medication that I take to knock me out. And then when it wears off in the morning, the shakes wake me up. And that's what I wake up in anxiety and terror every morning. I wake up and then I realize I'm just, you know, lying there. And it happens every night. It's been happening for decades. For decades. That's how my life is. You know, and to find somebody or hear somebody that has a story as abusive and mentally off the rails of this, I have yet to find anyone other than, I think, the guy who, Dave, I forget what his name is, but he wrote the book, A Child Named It.
Right, yes.
Dave Peltzer.
Dave Peltzer, right.
Right. I can relate to him a bit. I mean, his mother was like on the crazy side, but I can relate to the deprivation, you know, because I was deprived. I was deprived of love, food, not water, because we had water everywhere. But, you know, love, I mean, I had a shelter, but in the wintertime, it was freezing cold, you know, and I suffered, you know, and I had clothes, yeah, but they didn't fit, or they were girls' clothes, or because I had big feet as a kid, and the kids my age, I'd buy their boots from them, and they were always too small, but I wore them for a season, and then I'd buy a new pair of boots from them during the next season, and I'd steal the money to pay for the boots. So it was this... I had to really change as a person over the decades because I had become a thief, a liar. You name it, everything to cover up and survive. I had to become this other person. And then by the time I got older and I had kids, I had to become another person again and shed all of that, what I had become because of my experiences, because it changed the chemicals in my body. I didn't go through puberty till I was 21. I was stunted in my growth. Yeah, I didn't have hair under my arms till I was 21. And even when I was 21, I had like maybe 10, and you could barely see them unless you looked up really close. Even to this day, I don't have that much at all either. And my wife noticed that about me, that, you know, because we got married at 20 and 19, you know. And I was 126 pounds when we got married, 6 feet, 1/2 inch and 126 pounds. I suffered from bulimia. I was throwing up all the time. I just couldn't figure out how to deal with life. I couldn't figure out how to do life. You know, how do normal people do this? I mean, the simplest things of life, waking up in the morning, falling asleep at night, first of all, waking up in the morning, going to a job, staying at that job all day without having some sort of breakdown where I've got to get out of there, you know? And I still have those symptoms today. I mean, you know, that's why I'm home today. Because, you know, I'm a musician. Yeah, I play a few times, a few hours a week.
Well,
and,
I know,
I'm done.
I know my co-host Tim has a couple of questions for you as well. Tim, please sure. Go ahead.
And as someone who dabbles in guitar, I get the idea of the almost the serenity, the
yes.
deep serenity of it, and losing yourself in the guitar, and almost the hypnosis of it, the fact that you can get lost yes. in it. Now, I want to ask you a little bit yes. about the creative process of it, because a lot of guitarists say that when they're creating, it's almost like you get that from another source. It's almost like you're a filter that the creative, almost like the notes come from somewhere else. It flows through you and goes through you and into the guitar.
Right.
Let me ask you this question, because it seems to me like that guitar is therapy for you. It's almost like it takes you away. You mentioned school, like you achieved in school, then you dropped it because you found the guitar. To me, it seems like that was your escape. Then the guitar was your escape. Okay.
Yes.
Let me ask you this simple question and I'll let you go from here and take it from here. If that guitar has now become almost your spiritual outlet or your escape, as it were, and you're funneling this this almost spiritual outlet where you're getting this serenity, where do you believe you're pulling this the serenity, the spirituality from when you're creating?
Well, you know, I have, from all of this, I had become a Christian. And my hope in the Lord, that is where I gain my strength from now. And that is the only place where I gain my strength from. When I first started playing guitar, when I found guitar in the midst of this mess, I noticed that when I was playing it, I forgot about everything else. And that was the therapy. I recognized that very early, that, oh my gosh, here's something that takes me away. The other thing about it was I loved nature. So spending as much time out of the house, I would go walk up the rivers for 20 miles. I would go walk up the rivers for like 15-hour days and disappear and come home at 11 o'clock at night, leave at 7 in the morning, come home at 11 o'clock at night and walk 40 miles or so. And that was extremely peaceful and therapeutic to me. But as far as guitar, you know, music is, I'm not going to say it was an escape back then. It's not an escape anymore. It's a love. I mean, I love playing music. I love to be able to play something that sounds good to me. And then if somebody else hears it, great. If they enjoy it. And, you know, actually right now I've got probably 7 songs on worldwide radio on Smooth Jazz right now. And, which is fantastic. But, the way I use guitar and the way I play guitar is not an escapism anymore. It's more like maintenance. I mean, I love playing music, but it's maintenance for me. It's maintenance for that keeps me grounded, because it's the only thing that I can do where within 5 minutes I forget about everything. Mm-hmm. And I feel so peaceful. And my music reflects that. All of my music, everybody says, oh man, I love your music, man. It helps relax me. And I said, well, that's my therapy. That's why I create it. I play what I want to hear. And when other people get that, they're like, oh man, it makes me so chilled, so relaxed. You know, people write me from all over the world saying, oh, I listen to your music. I come home, you know, after a Friday night, beat up at work, and I throw your album on, and man, that does it for me. I sit there and I sip a glass of wine and I won't move until I finish listening to the whole album. And I said, that's exactly what I do. You know, that is the therapy and the peace behind it.
Have you ever,
you know, that I've enjoyed even to this day.
Have you ever, as you've sat and composed, or as you're sitting and you're getting an idea for a song or even for an album, as you're sitting there and you're going through and you're getting the notes and you're getting the composition, are you also getting messages that are telling you that things are going to be okay? Or are you subtly getting messages that maybe are turning you around? No. When I play music, it's like I said before, it's maintenance. It's maintenance. It's what I love to do. I mean, I've been doing it since I was 13. When I first picked up the guitar, that was it. I actually quit school to play guitar so I could play 10, 12 hours a day. But unfortunately that left me more time with my mother, but, I don't get any messages. I play because I enjoy it and I love the peace of it. And I connect with, there's a certain group of people, fans out there worldwide that I connect with that write me, and every message I ever get from anybody always says the same thing. And it's like, your music makes me feel so peaceful and it makes me forget about my troubles.
And I write back everybody who contacts me. And I say, you know, whoever that person is, I said, that's exactly why I write it. That's exactly why I play it, because it helps me forget about my troubles. It is, you know, we have to be balanced in life. You have to eat right. You have to exercise. You have to have an outlet. And that has been my outlet. You know, in the early days, yes, it was an escape. It was new to me. It was exciting. It was an escape. I left my country to come and, you know, sleep under the Santa Monica Pier, you know, because I wanted to pursue music, you know, because back in the 80s, you know, that's where music was happening. Los Angeles, Hollywood was the center. So that's where I went, you know, and I had no problems being homeless. You know, anything was better. I was virtually homeless anyway, even though I grew up in a home. I spent more nights sleeping in parks and at friends' houses and just not coming back home because of the situation. But the music was the only thing through all those years, except for going out in nature, that made me forget. After 5 minutes of picking up guitar and playing, it made me forget. I'm an improviser. Because of my ADHD, I've got so horrible bad ADHD that I'm an improviser. I can't focus. I can't read books. Never read a book in my life. I went through school faking it. You know, and to this day, I don't read books. I can't read books. I can't focus on it. I just can't, you know, but playing is a whole different thing. It's a visual thing. It's a sound thing. You know, in my book, I tell about that. I tell about the joys of sound from 3 years old, where I discovered that sound was so incredible. You know, I describe about pushing marbles across a floor and listening to that thunder when you put your ear to the floor while your big bag of marbles was rolling across the floor. And that was the beginning of instrumental. And I'm an instrumentalist. That's what I do. And it started at 3 years old. That's really where my inspiration came from.
Very cool. So yeah, I'm glad to see that you do have some moments of respite, some moments to get to yourself, and that you're carving that out. Michael, thank you for sharing your story with us on this. And as I said off air, I'm going to make sure that we connect you with a few resources that I think might be able to help you and break this spiritual connection, because I think your story is powerful, obviously. And there are others out there that are listening that have dealt with this and are afflicted with dealing with this. And whether it is madness of a family that's been passed on through a spiritual way, I believe that that's very possible too, that, you know, obviously there was a chink in the armor for your mother and other family members that allowed darkness to seep in that was above and beyond normal insanity. And that we make these connections, which is something we're going to talk about tonight on our live presentation, the connections we make with one another and how those need to be severed so that we can regain control of our own lives and find ways to ground ourselves. But I know some people that are proficient in this, and with your approval, I will make some introductions and see if we can help you get to the bottom and start your healing process.
Sure.
All right.
Thank you.
Michael, thank you for coming on and sharing. And please keep in touch with me as your story progresses. If there's more that occurs, if you do find help through any of the resources we're able to offer you or others, please let us know how you're progressing with that. Would you do that?
Yes. Thank you so much. Appreciate you guys having me on. It's been a pleasure. It's actually very therapeutic to talk about it.
Well, we're here, and we're always happy and have an open door policy that if you need that, we're more than willing to be here for that. So please reach out to us in the future. Folks, if you're listening and you're dealing with this, obviously you're not alone, and there are opportunities to get help. And although mainstream science and therapies may not have worked for you, I believe that there are others that can. And I don't want you to give up. Michael has not given up. Although he has struggled and dealt with things, you see, he is also still living a life. And that should be a sign to you that there is hope.
Yes.
There is light. And I hope that that all of you will find that as well. Michael, stay safe. Everybody out there, stay safe. Be kind. Be aware of your surroundings, aware of the things that are going on in your life, and seek help sooner rather than later, instead of allowing it to entrench you and drag you down. try to get that help. And if you have trouble finding that help, please reach out to us and we'll do our best to connect you with somebody that might be able to bring that to you. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.